Welcome to the Ask a Theologian podcast with your host, Dave Olson. This is the show where profound theological ideas meet everyday understanding. Dave's years of experience as a pastor means he cares about breaking down the often dense and intimidating world of theology into approachable, user-friendly ideas. Whether you're curious about the revolutionary concept of the Trinity, the biblical lens on equality, or what it means to see humanity through God's eyes, this podcast is your guide to making sense of it all. Through engaging conversations with theologians and a dash of humor, the Ask a Theologian podcast invites you to explore faith, theology, and life from a fresh and insightful perspective. So grab a cup of coffee, settle in. The Ask a Theologian podcast with your host, Dave Olson.
Welcome to today's episode of Ask a Theologian. I'm privileged today to have Dr. Lisa Stevenson with us. Dr. Stevenson is an associate professor of systematic theology at Lee University in Cleveland, Tennessee, the infamous home of the Cleveland School, at least according to Dr. Ken Archer. And Dr. Stevenson's also the author and co-author, worked on several books. Our first being Dismantling the Dualisms for American Pentecostal Women in Ministry, which I think is going to be a very interesting read. As well, she co-edited a book called Grieving, Brooding, and Transforming. And most recently this year, published co-authored a book on Redemptive Service. So Dr. Stevenson, thanks so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here and to share with your listeners some ideas that we're going to talk about.
Yeah, it's good. We're gonna jump into the topic of theological anthropology. It's a big topic, but why do we care about theological anthropology? Why does the average person in church want to know anything about theological anthropology?
Yeah, that's a great question. So my first response would be, beginning in Genesis 1, we can't escape theological anthropology pretty quickly. If we're going to read in the narrative of Scripture, we get this beautiful affirmation of humanity that is created in the image of God. And that right there is a very profound and deep theological statement about our beings as human beings here in creation, and even what God has called us to do and be while we're here on this earth. Right. Why should we care about it? Because I think God cares about it, and God's intention was for us to reflect His glory. And we see that from the get-go in the narrative of Scripture.
Awesome. When we talk about Genesis 1, I'm glad you brought that up, because it is, we talk about the Imago Dei, which I would probably say is one of the first pillars in theological anthropology. But can you talk a little bit more about what that actually means for us? What is the Imago Dei?
Sure. That is a complicated theological question, but let's try to make it easier. It is this profound statement that we have in Genesis 1. We're made in the image of God. Now, how we've understood that, what exactly is the image, that has been up for debate within church history for the last 2,000 years. But a lot of Old Testament scholars think that when the writers were writing that, one of the things that they had in mind minimally is that it had to do with humanity as an agency or presence of God in the midst of creation. So we represent the God who created us, and God has given us stewardship over creation and the world within which God has put us to create, to cultivate, to sustain, to promote well-being and flourishing for all of creation. So I think that is a great way to understand Imago Dei. And then in the New Testament, we get this very Christological shaping of that idea, because Christ Himself becomes the image of God. And it's that image that we are now called to form ourselves and to live after, is to be Christ followers, right? Formed in His image. And as we're formed in His image, we're formed in God's image.
So really you brought in kind of two separate points. The theological or theology proper, the Imago Dei in Genesis, but then also the Christological, the incarnation or Imago Christi in as the second pillar. But I think from reading a lot of your articles and things that you've done, one of the big thoughts that you've brought to Pentecostal scholarship is really a third, at seeing this in a Trinitarian way, and maybe Pentecostally as a new. Can you talk about that with us today?
Yeah, I think we look at church history and we see Genesis 1, Imago Dei, developed pretty robustly. And then when we turn to the New Testament, image of Christ, Christological development. But I argue, as you noted, that I think we're missing out on a Trinitier approach in that I coined the phrase Imago Spiritus, but call it right. What you want. I think there's something going on in the outpouring of the Spirit that connects to theological anthropology and connects right. to what God has called us to be and to do, which is not separate from Imago Dei or Imago Christi, but is a fulfillment right. of those in a pneumatological fashion in which we see, again, what I do in some of my scholarship, what we see in the New Testament with image of Christ and the ways in which that theological identity has certain implications for how we live and how we're to behave. In the book of Acts, I think the same thing is true. Imago Spiritus brings about an ethical right. mandate for how we are to live and behave as well. So it very much is not just a charismatic infusion of the Spirit for spiritual sake, but also informs our identity and our theological anthropology.
So the event, the central event then becomes the Pentecostal Acts chapter 2. That becomes the central event which you build that argument on?
It is. Yes, exactly. I think with Pentecost, the outpouring of the Spirit, we see this different way in which the Spirit of God works amongst humanity and an right. outpouring that's not limited to people, to tribe, to nation, to tongue, but that is truly open for all to receive and to transform us all.
Now, one of my professors in Bible college was Roger Strunstad, who I'm sure you've heard Roger's. And Roger talked about Luke's Pentecostal theology. And of course, he saw Pentecost being something different. And I think you and he would probably find yourselves in a little bit disagreement over that. But what, in looking at pneumatologically, looking at this kind of third pillar, what does that contribute to our understanding of theological anthropology?
One of the things I think it can contribute to, a number of things, but again, to go back to the Trinitarian identity, if you read other theologies of Imago Dei and Imago Christi, there's very little discussion of the Spirit, even within those starting points. And I think right. we're missing out on a pneumatological component even there. Christ is not who he is without the Spirit working in his life right. and leading him. If you read the Gospels, there's a strong Spirit Christology at work there. So we can't be Imago Christi without the Spirit. I don't think we right. can be Imago Dei without the Spirit, but taking the Spirit as our starting point, if you will, in theological anthropology, sure. frees us up from what at times has traditionally been a male-dominated metaphors and imagery okay. with respect to God and with Christ in a way that I think the Spirit overcomes, or at least isn't as encumbered by, with the way in which the Spirit kind of transcends embodiment, if you will, that God the Father and God the Son haven't right. because of the ways in which we speak of and reflect on that. So I think that is one of the aspects, as well as just connecting further. I think this outpouring of the Spirit, I am very familiar with Strunstad and what he and others have said. I very much think there is a charismatic nature to this outpouring of the Spirit at Pentecost, but to only limit it to that, right. to not see a soteriological right. connection, I think is actually to miss part of what is developing there in the narrative of the gospel and with what Luke is doing with his book of Acts. Again, this goes back to how does pneumatology inform theological anthropology? If the Spirit right. is poured out on all flesh, if both male and female are going to be infused with this presence of God and there's no distinction being made, and we see in other areas no distinctions being made, like in Jew and Gentile, then how does this right. inform our processes and our polity? And yes, we do have some hard texts in Scripture we need to wrestle with, but I don't think they're the only text. And right. they need to be held in tension with some of the other witness of Scripture, like we find in Acts, like we even find in the Gospels, in terms of the women who are a part of Jesus's life and ministry and witnessing to the resurrection and being the first to spread the gospel. How do these narratives right. of Scripture inform our approach here, and not just a few Pauline texts that seem to limit it? And even Paul himself, if you read some of his other things that he says and he notes, it does seem he's got women in leadership in various places in the church. So what do we do with all that?
Yeah, what do we do with all that? For my role as a pastor, the most typical pushback I would get on any of this would be Paul's texts. to Timothy, or particularly to Timothy. And to be honest, I don't always have a very good answer to that. How do you respond to those? And I know you've given kind of a general overview already.
Sure. I think there's a number of ways you can respond. First of all, I think it's a threefold approach, right? So this is what I tell my students. You got exegesis. So what do the texts say themselves? Yes. How can we understand them? Yeah. You've got hermeneutics. Even in light of what they say, how do we apply them to the 21st century church? Because just because it's in scripture doesn't mean there's this unilateral application. When we're talking about Christian ethics, we have to talk about what is the text saying in light of what God is calling us to do and be. We don't take everything in the Old Testament and apply it unilaterally in the New Testament. We understand that, and maybe there's something going on even with the New Testament. So in terms of hermeneutics, I think there's an issue there. And then how are other theological ideas in the scripture also informing it? So to talk about exegesis, there are brilliant New Testament scholars who have dealt with this passage, or multiple passages, and talked about how might we understand it. There's not just this one strict way. What did Paul really mean with some of these words he's using, some of which only show up in this one place in the New Testament? So how do we make sense of that? Right. In light of the fact that it does seem that Paul is open to women in leadership positions, especially when you look at Romans 16, where he mentions a number of female leaders and some other places, Priscilla in particular. How does that inform those readings and even other places where Paul seems to be pushing on some of the societal limitations of women? How does that help us exegetically to read it? I would point to some of those other New Testament scholars, because that is not my field per se, though I have read them. I think they come up with some really compelling arguments for why perhaps our English translations are missing some of the things, some of the nuances that the Greek context and culture would help us to understand with what's really going on in that particular letter to that particular church. And in light of that, maybe how we should understand it. So then you move to the issue of hermeneutics. How do we apply it? I find William Webb's hermeneutic, he calls it redemptive movement hermeneutic, in which he looks at scripture and he looks at three key issues. He looks at slavery, he looks at women, and he looks at LGBTQ issues, essentially. And he surveys Old Testament, he surveys the New Testament, and his claim, and I find it persuasive again, is we see movement on some of these issues. That there's not static ethic that we find in scripture itself, but we see movement. And he says his argument, and again, I'm persuaded by it. We see movement when it comes to slaves within Old Testament texts, between biblical culture versus secular culture, between Old Testament and New Testament, how they're treated, and even in New Testament, that culture versus biblical ethics. We see movement when it comes to women as well, but we don't tend to see movement when it comes to some of those sexual issues, because a lot of times it gets thrown in with those other two issues, and we want to say, well, it's all the same, right? It's not all the same. Right. It has to be studied separately, but he takes all three of those issues. But with respect to women, that what God is calling us towards is an ultimate ethic or an ultimate way to live. But in the texts themselves, we don't see that borne out yet. Right? We're moving towards it. We see the movement in scripture itself towards it, but those communities yet don't quite embody the full kingdom reality that God is calling us to.
Right.
So it's pointing us there, but it's not embodying it fully. So there's movement still to be had when it comes to the position of women. Our society and culture is not a first century society and culture. And so what are the implications for that? And then finally, theological issues. So I would take things like Imago Dei, things like Imago Christi, things like Imago Spiritus, Galatians 3, there's no Greek nor Jew, slave nor freeman, male nor female, issues of water baptism. There's other theological ideas that we can apply and bring to the issue of women in ministry and women in leadership that I think can help inform those conversations as well. So it's a full-on way to treat it that sometimes I think too often gets shortchanged to just let's talk about exegesis, which is very helpful and probably the beginning point, but there's some other things that have to be talked about as well.
Yeah, it's good. I think that's really good. One of the articles you wrote, and I can't remember exactly which one it was, but you talked about in context that circumcision was, or that water baptism is the new circumcision.
Yeah, so Paul essentially says this.
Yeah, honestly, I've never read that before. And that was something I was actually working through and I went, that makes sense to me. So certainly circumcision's the issue, then we're talking about a male-only
right.
scenario. But once it's baptism, water baptism, it's a completely different situation, which I just thought was just great. I encountered a statement you made in your book on dismantling dualism. And of course, it comes out of the introduction. It's in the first chapter. But the statement, it was such a strong statement. I'd love if you could just chat about it a little bit. The statement is, integrating women into an hierarchy from which they have previously been excluded is tantamount to integrating African-American slaves into a white supremacist society from which they have been previously excluded. It's a strong statement. What are you trying to say in that?
What I'm trying to say there, again, I haven't looked at that in quite a while, but...
Sure, I realize that.
Sure, so I'm pulling off of one of the ideas that I think the feminist movement and feminist theology has brought to our attention is you can't just add women in stir, that there are cultural and sociological dynamics that come into play with the structures that have been built over the centuries. And so when we're looking to become more what God is calling us to become and to realize those kingdom ideals, we can't just add women and think that's all we need to do, but we actually need to look at the infrastructure, look at our ways of behaving and performing, and ask if there's not some things there that need to change in addition to making the table bigger. And there tends to be, especially in traditions in which women have been excluded from leadership or ministry or whatever, whenever that polity is changed, right. The change needs to happen in more than just the polity, because there's a change that has to happen in our hearts and in our minds. And that takes a while, and that takes some introspection on behalf of the tradition and the denomination and the people who are in power, who are saying, no, we now welcome anyone. But if we look at statistics across the board, across various denominations, we see that doesn't actually play out. And so then it raises questions of, well, what's really going on here? And why do we say we're welcoming to all who would be in leadership, but when we look at the leadership, that diversity isn't there, right. And they're getting small churches, they're not being paid the same. A lot of times that then means that they have to have dual jobs and various things like that. So what I mean is, just like you can say, there's no more slavery, right? We're going to abolish it legally. It doesn't mean our hearts and minds have changed, right? We can still see other people as the other and not want anything to do with them, even though legally that's not accepted anymore. So what I'm trying to get at is, we can change our polity, but if we don't actually change our heart posture, we're going to have problems still until God can renew our hearts and minds. And actually, going back to the idea of an image of God, until we can see others as fully the image of God in that integrity and in that value and that worth, and who has things to offer as equally as I have to offer, there's going to be issues.
Right. Yeah, that's right. So getting the policies changed isn't going to change the heart.
Correct. Policy does need to change, but it's not like that's the only thing that needs to happen.
The denomination I used to be part of would be the Canadian equivalent to Assemblies of God. And I think the understanding would have been, women can pastor, but there's just this limitation. But even as that's changed on paper, I don't see any women on national executives or on provincial or territory executive, any of the other executives, district executives. It just doesn't seem to happen. So, and I believe it's similar in other Pentecostal denominations in the United States. One of the other things that I think you have spoken into is, we're looking at this really at this moment from a North American perspective. How does this translate into now a global, where the majority of the world is not United States, Canada, it's not. And we've talked about the global South, but really the majority world, where Pentecostalism is growing rapidly. What do we need to do? How does this work there? And I realize we're dealing with lots of different cultures, but are we dealing with the same issues?
Yeah, I think we might be dealing with some of the same issues, though. My limited experience and knowledge of those different places is that in some ways they've overcome it. In Latin America, I've heard of, just because of necessity sometimes, that the harvest is plenty, but the laborers are few, and the women are there. And so they're being used in ways that maybe wouldn't be permissible or allowed in places like the U.S. and Africa, especially where Pentecostalism is exploding. I met a female archbishop. That was her title. And she was in charge of multiple churches. So I think global Pentecostalism, it's going to be interesting to see how that comes into play and perhaps changes some dynamics and approaches to things. Though I think there are still issues that will probably also be faced as well with different cultures and their approaches towards men and women. We run into some similar problems, regardless of culture, on certain ideas.
It's when you talk about the need in Latin America, and Harvest is great. When I look at Pentecostal history, early days, Azusa Street, the decade or so after, women had a lot larger role, and then it was reduced. Really, I think that would be the only way to look back at it, because the need was great, so everybody could do that. Maybe what we really need is we just need another revival that just really gets things rolling.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, but those women missionaries, they would go out and there was no one there to tell them they couldn't, essentially. And they saw the need and they did what needed to be done.
Yeah, I have an aunt who passed away a couple of weeks ago, but she traveled for a couple of years as an evangelist with another woman, a number of places in Canada back in the early 40s and 50s. That was a different situation. Yeah, I think the systemic aspect of it is definitely going to be difficult. I think we have a long ways to go, in that area. One of the other things that I would get maybe pushback on is somebody would say, okay, it's okay. In fact, I just read it in something that John Bevere's arena. Women can preach and teach and lead as long as they are under a male's as long as they're submissive to their husbands, which is, so if they're, it sounds more like Islam to me, but what do you say to that? And I realize you're married, but there's single women and we don't celebrate singleness as much as we should. But how do you respond to that?
A couple of ways to respond to it. Again, they go back to the text. They're getting that from certain passages of scripture that they're focusing on.
It's the Ephesians.
Yeah, you have the Ephesians text. You've also got the one in, I believe it's 1 Corinthians, where Christ is the head of the church husband is the head of the wife.
Adam's the head of Eve. And
that
Adam,
passage.
All of that. Eve was deceived, exactly, not Adam. Exactly. Yeah, that one's a problem.
So again, I think we need to look at exegesis. What's going on here? What is being said? Yes, we have our English translations, but sometimes that doesn't pick up on the nuances of what's going on in the Greek, the nuances of what's going on in the culture. And there's, again, been some great New Testament scholars to talk about how we might be misreading these texts to understand this fixed hierarchy here. Right. This word head mean authority, but it can also mean source. And so maybe a better reading of some of these passages is to understand it as source language rather than authority of headship, if you will. But even if we want to press into that, what does it mean for Christ to be the head of the church? So Christ is the head, okay? And that's my head. Yeah. But that doesn't limit my ability to serve him here on earth. Yes, he is ultimately my head as well as your head, all of our heads. And it's under his authority that we minister, and it's under his name that we do the things we do in ministry. So we can have a sort of headship, if you will, but it's a Christological headship rather than just a marital one, which is usually, it's not always marital, it sometimes is. But I think we're missing the conversation on Christological headship and how that might inform how we understand this terminology, as well as, like I said, the exegetical stuff on source versus authority.
For those that are listening, I'd refer you back to my conversation with Dr. Ken Archer, and you might have some additional insights on that. Just as we wrap this up, you've mentioned a number of New Testament, or you've made reference to New Testament scholars who would be good to read. Can you recommend a book or a scholar? Scott McKnight comes to mind immediately, and Nijay Gupta, but are there others that you might recommend, or a book that you might recommend that just help people see this?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me recommend a book and a website, if you will, because they're the same thing. So there is a group of evangelical Christians who go by the name Christians for Biblical Equality, CBE. They have a website that is phenomenal in terms of resources. There's a number of things on their website, but one of them is a link to sources, so you can look up scripture verses and get feedback on it. You can look up topics and get feedback. So it's a wonderful resource. But that group also has a published book called Christians for Biblical Equality. No, now I'm getting it confused. Give me one second and I'll get it right. Okay, the group is called Christians for Biblical Equality. Their book is called Discovering Biblical Equality. And it's a thick book, but it is actually a compilation of chapters from different scholars. So it's not the same scholar, which I think is very helpful.
Okay.
And so if you like those scholars, you can then obviously look and find their works. But it's got different chapters, some that deal with the biblical text, some that deal with the theological ideas that we've been talking about, some that deal with cultural issues, and then some that deal with practical application. So if you're looking for one source, I would say this is the source to turn to. That is Discovering Biblical Equality. It is coming from evangelical Christians who are doing good scholarship. And it's an accessible book. It's not too heady that you'd get lost in all their jargon.
Okay. That's great. That's awesome. Dr. Stevenson, thank you so much for your time today. We covered a lot, and I know so much of it's going to be helpful to our listeners, and I appreciate your insight.
Great,
so
thank you.
Again. All right.
This has been the Ask a Theologian podcast with your host, Dave Olson. It's a passion for Dave to have on theologians that break down the often dense and technical world of theology into approachable, user-friendly ideas. No thought or questions are off the table. We hope you've enjoyed the show. If you did, make sure to like, rate, and review. We'll be back soon, but in the meantime, find us on Instagram at the Ask a Theologian podcast. And on X, it's Ask Theologian. Take care, and we'll see you next time on the Ask a Theologian podcast.